My mind, on my lips, in my heart. My brothers and sisters, this reading comes to us this evening from the Holy Gospel according to Luke. While some people were speaking about how the temple was adorned with costly stones and votive offerings, Jesus said, "All that you see here, the days will come when there will not be left one stone upon another stone that will not be thrown down." And then they asked, "Teacher, when will this happen? And what sign will there be when all these things are about to happen?" And he answered, "See that you are not be deceived. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and 'the time has come.' Do not follow them. When you hear of wars and insurrections, do not be terrified, for such things must happen first, but it will not immediately be the end." Then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be powerful earthquakes and famines and plagues from place to place, and awesome sights and mighty signs will come from the sky. Before this all happens, however, they will seize and persecute you. They will hand you over to the synagogues and to prisons. They will have you led before kings and governors because of my name. It will lead you to your giving testimony. Remember, you are not to be prepare yourselves, your defense beforehand, for I myself shall give you wisdom in speaking, that all the adversaries will be powerless to refuse and to refute. You will be handed over by parents, by your brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. You will be hated by all because of my name, but not a hair on your head will be destroyed. By your perseverance, you will secure your lives." The Gospel of the Lord. After several years on a stint in Africa, a European missionary, a white European missionary, he went home for a visit and returned after a few weeks back to Africa with a fine set of colorful posters that he used to illustrate to them his sermons. And as he had hoped, the pictures proved to be of great success. Each Sunday after the liturgy, many of the parishioners would linger around the posters and they would talk about what they got out of them and what they had learned. And one day, near the end of the liturgy year, liturgical year, like we are now, we're at the end of the liturgical year, the missionary chose to preach on the end times and the consequences, both good and bad, that will coincide with Jesus' return as judge and savior of all. And so he set up the appropriate posters at the door of the church, as he ordinarily did, and then he went into the sacristy to prepare for Mass. And then, before long, he heard whoops and delight of laughter and people laughing, and he turned around to see that the parishioners were standing before one of the posters. And so, surprised, he, in a little bit indignant, he called for silence. And then he asked, how could anyone find humor in the prospect of final judgment? And he said, "Hell is no laughing matter." He was a very traditionalist priest. But anyways, then one of the revelers took his arm and led him to the poster, saying, "Father, don't you see? Look, all the people in hell are white." Shouldn't be laughing. It does bring a laugh, but beyond its humor, it points to an underlying notion that has been variously expressed throughout the ages. And that is, when human beings are faced with the fact of the great reckoning, to end all reckonings, some of us tend to focus on what might happen to others, what their outcome's going to be. I mean, remember the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre? One of his favorite lines? Anybody know it? "Hell is other people." And I think some of us think that hell is for other people, which we can all name. And also in the Inferno, in his Inferno, the first part of the Divine Comedy by the Italian poet Dante Alighieri, who exercised a similar prerogative in identifying which people would be relegated to which circles of hell. If you've ever seen a painting of it, you'll see that there's bishops and popes there. And by the way, we do get our modern understanding of hell from Dante, from that, rather than his writing, rather than from the Bible, because the Bible really doesn't speak of hell. It speaks of Sheol, the underground, that's where the place of the dead was, but it doesn't speak of hell in the way that we think about it. Anyways, although the desire to assign places for others in the afterlife may prove tempting, the sacred text in their authors summons us to put our attention and our energies elsewhere. Do they call us to look within ourselves and find cause to worry about the end times? Hope not. But do they invite us to forego criticizing the speck in another's eyes while we're ignoring the beam that is in our own eyes, as we often do? Do they urge us against procrastination that keeps us from continuing the work of Jesus to bring justice and peace and love in this world? In some ways, the living word that guides us all throughout the liturgical year indeed does offer these suggestions to us. They're there. But I think more importantly, before any suggestions can be taken to heart or any answers truthfully, questions truthfully answered, the sacred authors direct us believers collectively and individually to look to God. And so that's what we're to do. We're to look to God, to try to see into the heart of God and to know the heart of God, to see with God's eyes. Eyes that see everything and everyone is sacred. And looking at God does not mean that we have to seek the beatific vision or wait for some kind of dramatic theophany. But rather, looking at God means taking a cue from our ancestors in faith, who learned to discern the face of God by remembering all that God had done for them, and that God was their creator, their protector, their provider, their guide. God was their liberator, their friend, champion, their mother, their father, their brother, their breath. God had been their loving, faithful, and forgiving spouse. So that God was with them always and everywhere, even when they perceive, even when we perceive things aren't going the way we want them, God is with us. And looking at God created an ambiance of truth in which they saw not only God, but themselves. And the fact that their sins had distorted the image of God that they were created to reflect in this world. And looking at God also kept them from looking at one another with disdain and fear. On the contrary, looking at God gave them a new prism, a new way of looking and seeing through the eyes of God, to see others with eyes of sympathy and empathy, with appreciation and respect, the place where God dwelled. And so as we look at God's face as it has been reflected in our own lives over this past year, we also will probably experience the painful truth that perhaps we have not been all that we should have been, nor have we done all that we could to reflect to the fact that we belong to God. And nevertheless, we're to leave the judging of ourselves and our judging of others to God. We are to set aside our fears and speculations. We are not to listen to naysayers or to prophets of doom. Rather, we are to persevere in trusting God, just as Jesus did. I mean, look at his situation. Much worse than our own, being occupied by the Romans and all that entailed. And I know in my own life, like my master, Jesus, I have discovered that it is only love and only faith that can see me and see us through anything. And so, my brothers and sisters, we are to busy ourselves with the ministry that Jesus entrusted to each and every one of us who are his followers, instead of minding the business of others or worrying about what the future holds. But we're to continue to look at God and struggle, if we have to, each day to give ourselves, to give our country, to give the world, to give all others to God's keeping. We are to witness to the transcendent love that upholds us all, and to remember the words of Julian of Norwich, which I have cited many times, and which I hope you all know. And that is, she said that all will be well. All will be well. All manner of things will be well.